Chapter 13, The Last Passover Meal, Washing of the Feet, Peter's Denial. Verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. After the events discussed in the previous chapter, it was clear to Jesus that this would be the last Passover he would spend with his beloved disciples. You may recall that he had come to this decision when the God-fearing Greeks sought him out. Additionally, the content of this chapter comes on the heels of the previous confrontation with the Eudaioi and Jesus' presentation of himself as the Good Shepherd who came to judge the evil shepherds of Israel. This verse begins by stating that the Good Shepherd of Israel, Jesus, loved his own sheep with the highest commitment and dedication possible. It is difficult to say with precision to whom his own refers to. These words appeared in John 1:11b. His own did not receive him. The most coherent way to understand this would be to think of the disciples of Jesus belonging to the Eudaioi, just as Jesus did himself. Verse 2. During supper, when the devil had already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments, and taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. It is clear that in one of his last interactions with his disciples, Jesus wanted to personally model something very important for them to understand. The normal way to see this text is as disconnected from the overall context of John's Gospel, as a polemic between Jesus and Jerusalemite leaders. In other words, today's Christians normally see this feet-washing ceremony as only applicable to all Christ followers in the world as an example of true humility. However, I suggest that while this example applies by extension to all Christ followers, in this present context, it meant something else. Please let me explain. Jerusalemite leaders were known for not caring for the needs of others. They did not care for the needs of Israel, and they fought tooth and nail with each other for their own privilege and status. Jerusalemite leadership was not very different from what we now know of the modern dynamic of infighting in the corporate world. Everyone was looking out for himself. It was very much like, "Am I my brother's keeper?" type of approach. Jesus' washing of the feet of his disciples and wiping them with a towel was a way of expressing to them that their leadership over Israel must be very different from that of the current leaders. We have already seen something like this happen when Mary of Bethany demonstrated such a commitment to Jesus by pouring oil on his feet and drying them with her hair. The number of selected disciples, being 12, was not coincidental. Jesus chose 12 disciples because his plan included the full renewal of Israel. The 12 heads of the tribes of Israel were to be now represented by the 12 Jewish apostles who would lead Israel into a renewed future defined by redemption. We can see this idea in the description of the New Jerusalem in the book of Revelation, Revelation 21. It had a large high wall with 12 gates. 12 angels were at the gates, and the names of the 12 tribes of Israel were written on the gates. There were 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. The wall of the city had 12 foundations, and the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb were written upon them. We read in verse 3, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, Jesus rose to wash the feet of his disciples. As we noted earlier, this was one of the last and most important leadership training sessions Jesus would have with those who were to become the good shepherds of Israel. They were to rule the new Israel with an attitude of utter self-sacrifice and care. Verse 6. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" Jesus answered him, "What am I doing? You do not understand now, but afterward you will understand." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands, my head." Jesus said to him, "The one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you." For he knew who was to betray him. That was why he said, "Not all of you are clean." When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, "Do you understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so am I. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that you should also do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor a messenger greater than the one who sent him." Peter made his opposition known by simply voicing the bewilderment of the other disciples. How could it be that the greater would serve the lesser? Jesus responded by saying, unless he lets Jesus wash his feet, Peter would not be able to share in the crucial service of the good shepherds. Peter, naturally thinking that Jesus was speaking about ceremonially water cleansing when he said, "You are clean," offered to go through the entire ceremony, mikvah, as no doubt they all did on a more or less regular basis. Jesus specified that the mikvah ceremony had already made everyone ceremonially clean. Although the mikvah generated clean status to the Israelite, it must also be matched by being cleansed from within. Jesus made it clear that not all who went through the ceremony before Passover were actually clean within, certainly not Judas Iscariot. In John 15, although in a completely different context, we read, "You," speaking to disciples, "are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you." Washing the feet of the guests was the task of the youngest family member or servant. He would wash the dirty feet of newly arrived guests coming into a house from the outside. Although the disciples were Jesus' servants, here we see Jesus being a servant to them. In verse 14 and 15, Jesus' logic once again is a reversed form of a later rabbinic Kal v'chomer, from light to heavy, argument as we discussed it in previous chapter. If someone great does this, then how much more should those who are lesser do the same thing? The conclusion was inescapable. If he did it for them, how much more should they be willing to do the same for others? To be true shepherds of God's people Israel, they too must be trustworthy, humble, and not self-seeking. Jesus would later challenge Peter from the context of Ezekiel's prophecy of the evil shepherds of Israel with the words, "Feed my sheep." Verse 17. "If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. I am not speaking of all of you. I know whom I have chosen. But the scripture will be fulfilled. He who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. I am telling you this now before it takes place. Then when it does take place, you may believe that I am he." Although this was not his focus, Jesus predicted future events. Everything was done so that the apostles would be strengthened in their faith before a time of very difficult service that lay ahead of them. On the battlefield, ancient soldiers engaged in a symbolic act of domination over the defeated enemy. If the enemy laying on the ground and heavily wounded was still alive, they would take their foot and place it on the neck of the defeated enemy as a symbol of their victory. If I'm right, then Judas did not seek the death of Jesus, but hoped that the attempted arrest would cause Jesus to finally exercise his messianic powers to start a successful insurrection, then this statement in verse 18 would fit perfectly. Judas's sin was not that he quote-unquote sold Jesus for 30 pieces of silver, but that he actually lifted up his heel over Jesus's neck by trying to force him to do his will. Verse 20. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever receives the one I send receives me, and whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. In this concluding remark, Jesus once again showed the importance of the 12 apostles he was leaving in his place. He gave them all the authority necessary to lead God's people. Receiving them would mean receiving Jesus, the Son of Man, just as receiving Jesus meant receiving his Father, the Ancient of Days. The 12 had the authority to lead because Jesus himself promised to be with them always. Verse 21. After saying these things, Jesus was troubled in his spirit and testified, "Truly, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." The disciples looked at one another, uncertain of whom he spoke. The last person in the minds of the disciples who would be considered for the role of the betrayer of Jesus would have been Judas Iscariot. Remember, while Matthew was best at accounting, he was once a tax collector, it was Judas Iscariot who was entrusted with the keeping of the group's treasury. At that time, he had the trust of the disciples and Jesus. But even more importantly, as a man who was highly skilled in defending the treasure bag from the hands of bandits that frequented the roads of the Roman Empire, Judas Iscariot's candidacy was out of the question. Verse 23. One of his disciples whom Jesus loved was reclining at table at Jesus' side. In a world where tables were on the same level as the floor, the disciples partook of their food reclining around the area where food was served. One of the disciples was this mysterious person known as the beloved disciple. There have been various theories put forth as to the identity of this disciple, and none of them are fully convincing to my mind. We read in John 21, "This is the disciple who testifies these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true." Verse 24. So Simon Peter motioned to him to ask Jesus of whom he was speaking. So that disciple, leaning back against Jesus, said to him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus answered, "It is he to whom I will give this morsel of bread when I have dipped it." So when he had dipped the morsel, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. Then after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered him. Jesus said to him, "What you're going to do, do quickly." Now no one at the table knew why he said this to him. Some thought that because Judas had the money bag, Jesus was telling him, "Buy what we need for the feast," or that he should give something to the poor. So after receiving the morsel of bread, he immediately went out, and it was night. We can almost feel the tension as Jesus spoke of his imminent betrayal by one of the disciples. The beloved disciple asked him quietly to show him who exactly would betray him. Jesus answered just as quietly, "I will show you now." It was customary to take a piece of bread, dip it into something tasty, and give it directly to another person nearby. This was the perfect way to tell the beloved disciple something in such a way that no one would guess what Jesus was really doing. Jesus showed the beloved disciple what others would only know later. As Jesus extended his hand to give the piece of bread to Judas Iscariot, he told him out loud that he should hurry up. Jesus had routinely given Judas and other apostles assignments, so it looked like nothing unusual had taken place. Verse 31. When he had gone out, Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself, and glorify him at once. Little children, yet a little while I am with you. You will seek me, and just as I said to the Judaioi, so now I also say to you, where I am going you cannot come. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. It is intriguing that while we normally ascribe the term glorification to Jesus only after his resurrection, Jesus does so in advance of the events. It seems that Jesus viewed betrayal, death, resurrection, and ascension as one package. So much so that at the time when the events had ultimately led to his death and resurrection begin, he was already able to say, "Now is the Son of Man glorified." One of the foundational stories of the 12 sons of Jacob was the story of Joseph's near killing and eventually being sold into slavery in Egypt. One can hardly speak of anything more unloving than the heads of Israel's key family attempting to murder their own brother. But it turns out that the Jewish tradition ascribes an especially negative role to Judah. Judah was to have been the leader of his brothers. Therefore, rabbinic sources hold him responsible for the deception, even though it was not Judah himself who brought the coat to Jacob. Even though Judah tried to save Joseph, the rabbinic sources still consider him responsible for it. As the leader of the brothers, Judah should have made a greater effort to carry Joseph home to Jacob on his own shoulders. These rabbinic sources argue that Judas's brothers would have listened to Judah and would have returned their young brother home. It is possible, if not probable, that the above-mentioned rabbinic sources reflect much earlier Jewish interpretive traditions. If so, then the name of the chief betrayer of Christ Jesus, a Joseph-like figure in the Gospels, is most appropriately called by the name of the betrayer of Joseph, the son of Jacob, Judah. If understood in this way, then Judah should not be connected with the Judea, the Jews in Judaioi, theologically and psychologically, but with the head of one of the Israelite tribes that otherwise received an honorable status in the Christian church at large. Therefore, highlighting this dynamic, Jesus commands the 12 to love one another, unlike their forefathers, and in so doing reverses the curse that seems to have been following Judean leadership up to the time of Jesus. Originally, the commandment to love one another just as I have loved you was spoken particularly to the 12. However, it applies by extension to all Christ followers everywhere and at all times. Verse 36. Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus answered him, "Where am I going? You cannot follow me, but you will follow afterward." Peter said to him, "Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." Jesus answered, "Will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, the rooster will not crow till you have denied me three times." Peter's commitment would soon be tested. Jesus told Peter that a time would come when Peter would deny him three times. That time was rapidly approaching. One of the reasons Jesus said this was because he already knew Judas Iscariot was on his way to the temple to betray his location to the authorities for his immediate arrest, illegal trial, and ultimate death at the hands of Roman soldiers. And this would be accomplished at the instigation of the Jerusalemite leadership of the Judaioi.